Welcome to New Thinking for a New World, a Tilburg Foundation podcast. I am Alan Stoga, your host. Each week, I bring you conversations with people who think differently about the great issues that are shaping our world. Geopolitics, disruptive tech, mass migration, the changing climate, culture wars, all of it is grist for our mill. I hope you enjoy listening. I also hope you will let me know what you think and that you join the conversation at tilburgfoundation.org. And now for today's episode of New Thinking for a New World.
In December of last year, the Tilburg Foundation hosted a webinar to celebrate the winners of the 2025 Tilburg S&F Eliason Global Leadership Prize. Brian Dorries, Rhett Butler, and David Gruber were selected by the prize jury from an initial pool of 1,500 nominations. These three amazing leaders will be honored in June in Athens, Greece, at S&F's celebration of 30 years of grantmaking. But that's too long to wait to get a sense of these leaders and their approach to leadership. In that spirit, Helena Nielsen, Deputy CEO of the Miele Institute in Sweden and an accomplished global businesswoman in her own right, interviewed Brian, Rhett, and David about the challenges of leadership today. This brief podcast captures the essence of that inspiring conversation. You can find a link to the full recording on the Tilburg Foundation website. Listen as Helena introduces our three laureates and then nominate a leader for the 2026 Tilburg Prize. Thank you.
Like Alan said, I had the pleasure of serving on the prize jury this year. So a super inspiring body of work, a very rigorous process, and that makes it even more special to be here with you. So by that, I would like to introduce the 2025 laureates of the Tilburg S&F Eliason Global Leadership Prize. And I thought I'd start with you, Rhett. So Rhett A.S. Butler founded and built Mungo Bay and has since served as the CEO. He's also a writer and a photographer. Mungo Bay is a non-profit news organization, a global digital platform for high-quality journalism that covers issues at the intersection of people and nature. A network of around 1,000 journalists in more than 80 countries, and I hear currently in 6 languages, but going on 8. Rhett received the Global Leadership Prize for redefining global environmental journalism through Mungo Bay, a network model of independent reporting that empowers local voices, informs global policy, and renews confidence in journalists as a source, as a force for accountability and change. Wonderful to have you here, Rhett.
Thank you.
Brian Dorries, wonderful to have you here as well. You're the co-founder of Theatre of War Productions and today serving as the artistic director. Brian and the Theatre of War production uses aged-old approaches to help individuals and communities to heal from trauma and loss through dramatic readings of ancient tragedies and seminal texts. They really frame community conversations about pressing existential questions and brings up that magic when people connect and look deep into themselves and each other. I think Brian's approach strips away what we think of as so special about the time that we are living in. Focus on instead of what makes us human. The magic of the conversations where brave spaces, but true reflection and real dialogue can take place, where empathy is at the core, and where people can listen deeply into both themselves and to each other.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here.
Thank you. And David, a marine biologist, an explorer, as well as the founder and president of the SETI Project, Cetacean Translation Initiative. So the Project SETI is a nonprofit organization that brings together over 50 scientists across many disciplines with an ambitious global effort to decipher the communication of sperm whales. And David and this team's pursuit of interspecies dialogues invites us to think what it means to be alive on a planet together, to change the perspectives we have on ourselves and reshape, or the possibility to reshape, the relationships with all life on Earth. David received the Global Leadership Prize for bringing together science, technology, imagination and empathy to decipher the language of whales, pointing towards new ways of understanding, interacting with, and protecting non-human life. Wonderful to have you here as well, David.
Thank you.
How do you think of yourself as a leader? I don't know who feels like to start. Would you like to start, Brian?
Sure.
Who are you as a leader? How do you think about
well,
that?
Well, I describe myself as a facilitator.
Facilitator, yeah.
And I've facilitated now thousands of events over the last 20 years all over the planet. And if I've done my work, two things happen. One, it's a disappearing act. And it's as if I hadn't been there to begin with. The group or the organization or the community that I'm engaging with takes ownership of the conversation and speaks on their own terms about it with great eloquence because of their proximity to the issues we're trying to discuss. So it's a disappearing act. And number two, I know I've done my job when the least powerful person in the room is speaking. When the person who never has the microphone in their hand or doesn't feel they deserve to be the person with the microphone in their hand is sharing their truth, their perspective. And I do see that that kind of facilitation is a type of leadership because it runs against the grain of the hierarchy of most institutions. So I see myself as someone who's facilitating and honoring and the wisdom in every room, whether that's, you know, we've done performances with Nobel laureates to a busload of tourists from New Jersey, to people who've no formal education whatsoever, but have the most important thing to say in the room. So I see it as an act of leadership. And then I would also say it is an act of leadership, as I was sort of alluding to before, to create leaderless spaces, to create spaces and places where, I mean, well, the Greeks knew 2,500 years ago that I feel like we're only rediscovering now, kind of in spite of ourselves, is there had to be places and spaces where communities could communalize, could collectively reckon with the moral, the spiritual, the ethical, the emotional dimensions of the choices that they had to make.
Right. What are your thoughts? I know you've been thinking about who are you as a leader a bit, or something, but how do you think about yourself as a leader? How would you describe your leadership?
Yeah, I mean, so traditionally I hadn't thought of myself as a leader. I just focused on the work. And so I guess you could say that it was leading by doing, but the leadership question has been coming up more lately. So I have had to do some reflection on it. And I really agree with what Brian said in terms of thinking of it as being more of a facilitator, and that part of success is being able to disappear if you're no longer needed. I would say that's kind of a guiding principle of how I operate at Manga Bay. But I guess if I do have to talk about being a leader, then I think part of it is creating clarity in terms of what our mission is, and then positioning people to be successful. So removing barriers, finding resources for them, empowering them to do their best work. And so when I switched from a for-profit where it was just, you know, me and another person kind of, you know, doing our journalism, I knew I was going to have to basically give up doing what I love, which was journalism. But that was going to have a much greater impact in the world because I could find resources to hire a team of journalists who are much better journalists than I was to do this work. And so it was enabling all these people to pursue their talents and you know, make the most of their abilities, whereas I could sort of go into the background and bring those resources to the table. I mean, it's been interesting because I kind of disappeared in the background, but I've now come back into the foreground. So it's been... It's been very serendipitous, but that's how these things evolve, I guess. I guess in my leadership capacity, part of it is just being able to listen really closely and then connect insights from wherever they come from across the environment, so not only the organization, but more broadly, and then helping people who have great ideas turn those into real impact down the road.
What are your thoughts, David? How do you think about yourself as a leader?
I think there's pieces of this that are really resonate, you know, in terms of being the facilitator and trying to be invisible. And also I'm kind of hearing what Rhett says of like, you know, starting out as a journalist, but then as you're a leader, you kind of have to let go a little bit of doing the work and then guiding the work. So changing role. I think with this project, it's interesting. And I'm also a college professor. So, you know, we're in this very individualistic professor setting, and maybe we run a lab, but Project SETI is also a nonprofit organization now, and had to completely like learn, you know, the how to run a nonprofit and how to keep a science team, which are all speaking very different languages in terms of even like, you know, the cryptographers speak different languages than the natural language processors and the machine learners. And there's a different culture in robotics than there is in computer science. Like it's, and especially the animal and the AI communities are very different. So really just listening, which I'm also kind of hearing from Brian and Red of like kind of listening, and good ideas could come from anywhere. And I think, you know, managing ego and really giving credit to your team and being with your team is important, and just learning all the time, and also seeking mentorship is important. You know, I'm traveling right now, but I even carried a book with me on this one, and it was a book that just happened to be on my shelf that one of my mentors, Roger Payne, who discovered that whales sing. And passed away a few years ago. He used to talk about this book all the time, but it's from The Little Prince, which, oh, there it is. You know, and it's just that line there of, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And I think especially running on a nonprofit budget, leadership style is much more about carrots and offering incentives to my team and getting them inspired, rather than kind of demanding things. So I really feel like my job is to continuously inspiring and keeping the mission clear and straight. And a lot of people on the team are working for much less than they could be making in industry. And they're doing that for a reason, you know, because they're believing in the wider mission of the good that we could create as a collective.
Beautiful.
I was going to say, it seems like, David, another aspect of leadership, at least listening to you talk, is also about modeling kind of ethical, and also, Rhett, like ethical, like built into both models, the sort of decentralizing of journalism and pushing it out into communities who are most proximal to the very things that need to be reported on, and seeing the perspectives of animals and humans from POVs that are also proximal to those beings, closest in proximity, and also gentle and ethical, are ways of modeling ethical. I would describe it as ethical leadership, and that ethical leadership also isn't about necessarily, as Rhett said, talking about yourself as a leader. It's about showing another way to a field that may not be able to see beyond the way it's done things traditionally, whether that's journalism, whether that's science or academia, whether that's the arts, which is from one perspective, the least consequential from my perspective of those fields in terms of the stakes.
Do you know leaders who, regardless of where they live or what they do, are changing the world? Leaders who are not content with what is and are working hard for what could be. Leaders with both a demonstrated track record and the potential for continued impact. Leaders whose work is innovative, courageous, rooted in universal values, and global in approach or implication. If so, please nominate them for the Telberg SNF Eliasson Global Leadership Prize at telbergprize.org.
How are you three helping next generations of leaders push boundaries and challenge their own assumptions? I think that could be in many different ways. What are your thoughts, Rhett? What comes up to you listening to that?
I mean, my general approach to life is to minimize assumptions as much as possible, especially when it comes to people, because I feel like when you enter into a situation with an assumption, it often puts you at a disadvantage or just wrong foots you. And so I encourage people to keep an open mind. I think it's really important, especially as a leader, because the world's changing really quickly and there are just so many opportunities out there that you sort of have to be aware of. We have a paid fellowship program. I think it may be too big a stretch, but we have a paid fellowship program, which is basically to create, opportunities for journalists in low and middle income countries who don't otherwise have opportunities to develop their skills and to build a portfolio. And so, these are almost, you could describe as micro leaders, because they're making decisions about what stories to elevate and communicate to the world. And so it's like it's a small step. It's not, leading an organization, but it is making decisions that affect other people's lives. And so, but again, the way we look at that is we want to create opportunities. We want to be sure that they are viable for people to actually participate. And we want to reduce barriers so they can, because of circumstances of their birth or, where they grew up, we don't want those to limit what they can do with their lives. And so I guess I would kind of like use that as like a microcosm for how we think about leadership.
How are you helping next generations of leaders push boundaries and challenge own assumptions?
No, I think that's a great question. I think about it from so many different angles. There's many ways I could think about it. One is I'm also an educator. So I work a lot with the kind of demographic of 18 to 22 year olds, which is always really nice to be in contact with that demographic to feel how they're seeing the world. And I think one of the things, so that's one side. We've also in the very earliest, in the beginning of SETI, we set up a marine conservation leadership program as part of it, embedded into the forming the organization. And that's based in Dominica, and that's for young Dominicans to engage in this work and to partake in it. And ultimately, as we're working very place-based in Dominica right now in the Eastern Caribbean to be giving this entire research project to be run entirely by them is the model that we have.
How do you stay open to what emerges? How do you balance this intentional versus the emergent, what comes up in your work? I know it's a tricky question, but I think it's one of those leadership questions that we need to ask ourselves, the intention and the emergence in a world that is pretty unstable on anything can happen. What are your thoughts, Brian?
Listen to you ask that question. I'm reminded of a mentor of mine, Peter Brook, the great stage director of the 20th century. He just died a couple of years ago. And I had the privilege of knowing him as a friend, but also working with him on some productions and even producing some of his work in a prison here in New York City, where I'm currently. And he wrote about something that really guided my work in one of his books called The Shifting Point. And it's the concept of the formless hunch. And what I like about it, and what he means it in terms of the theater, but it could be applied to any field, I think. And at the center of the formless hunch is a question: how can you possibly know what the form is until it emerges? And the only way, and so there's so much in our lives and our ways of operating that, I think falsely presume to know what the form is before it emerges. In the theater, we create the marketing and the costumes before we've even gone into rehearsal. And I'm sure the same could be said for biology or journalism. We put certain priorities ahead of the actual thing that we're trying to do. And then it somehow, in some ways, obstructs our ability to actually discover and unearth what the form really is. So what that means in my field is really taking time to develop ideas over many years.
The dance between the structure and the intent. Rhett, what are your thoughts? Intent, emergence, is that something that you think of, or how do you relate to that?
Well, I think, running a journalism organization that has a presence in so many places, because you need a vantage point of ideas that are percolating out there. There's just a great information flow coming across my desk every day. And so it is a place to pick up new ideas and see trends when they're very early. And recognize potential opportunities. And I think the other big thing is that my approach, again, I don't have a background in what I do now. I have no training as a journalist. I never had any experience fundraising or running a nonprofit, is taking a very iterative approach. And so being experimental, making small mistakes and avoiding catastrophic mistakes. And so, again, it fits really well with the journalism model because there's all sorts of information coming in. And so it's a place where we can test things. The other thing is that having all these different bureaus around the world is that we can experiment with ideas. And if they work in, say, Indonesia, bringing them to, you know, the global Manga Bay or Manga Bay, Brazil. And so that cross-border learning is also really important.
In a world where globalization seems to be fading, how do you sustain the notion that global challenges like climate change need global as well as local solutions? Question, but how do you think about that? Global solutions, local solutions.
I think we have to come at it from both angles. I don't think it's an either or. I think it would be both. And I guess to link it back to this last one, to this last question, is that being able to adapt quickly to stochastic dynamic settings is very important, because these are changing quickly. So I think it's about coming up with both global and local tactics and being able to change and modify at what is coming at it. But it's challenging. I mean, this is I'm not gonna cherry code it. This is one of the most complex dynamic issues that humanity has ever faced at this juncture. And I think it's taking all hands on deck to be able to kind of steer this into a not kind of catastrophic directions.
Brett, I think your work and Manga Bay's work is really you really try to work with that global and local aspect. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, that's, you know, close to ground, but still a global initiative or a global ambition.
Well, I think one way you interpret global solutions is not necessarily top-down control, but cooperating on problems across borders. So whether that's climate, oceans, biodiversity, you know, pandemics, whatever the topic is. And so there's a critical role there for local action. So the best solutions often start in community. And then when you talk about global collaboration, it's supporting and scaling those solutions. So, you know, you rarely come up with like a global solution that starts at a global level. Like, you need those local use cases to prove a concept or even come up with the ideas. And so, again, what makes our approach interesting is that we have all these local voices who are elevating these micro case studies, essentially, on what's working, how people are trying to solve problems, and then bringing them to a broader audience. And so we've had stories that we've done on community forestry in Indonesia, for example, and then we've learned that other communities have contacted those communities or us to learn how to replicate those ideas. And then we see people in Peru reaching out to people in Indonesia to learn more about what they're doing so they can try it. And so I think when you're talking about global solutions, it's really about scaling local solutions that are working.
Thank you so much. Thank you, all three.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of New Thinking for a New World. I'm Alan Stoga, podcast host, and I look forward to your joining our next conversation. Remember, tell us what you think at telbergfoundation.org.